In our series of little studies on Revelation. Now, of course, there may be some here that weren't here at the last meeting, and it will be difficult for us to relate all of the what has gone before. And it is necessary to understand these things as they are related to one another. And so if you haven't heard the past, it may be a little more difficult as we go along to pick up the threads of thought. But we're still early enough in the study so that it will be possible, I think, for us to relate the matters one to the other. To start off with, I think that it would be in order to just ask a few review questions concerning our study last time. Our study started off in what place? Where were we in vision? Who remembers?
In the chapter?
Yes, Revelation 12. Where were we?
We were in vision. We were in the heaven, the heavenly realms, with the picture of the dragon and the woman and with the stars. We were in the ecclesiastical or spiritual heavenly ruling realm.
That's right. This vision started off in heaven. And we saw a woman there, clothed with the sun and the crown on her head, false stars and so on. And then we also saw a dragon, and he too was in heaven. This dragon that we saw had seven heads and had seven crowns upon its heads, and I think for this we should turn in the picture here to help relate what we saw last time. This is the dragon that we were considering last week. This dragon, we observed, had something phenomenal about it. Being a phenomenal beast anyway, but more than in the ordinary, more than being dreadful, what did it have on its head?
Crown,
that's right. And it had seven heads, and it had seven crowns. And what did we understand these heads represented? Well, first, what did the dragon represent that we discussed?
Civil power.
Yes, the civil powers of the Roman Empire, we might add that. Not just any civil powers, but of the Roman Empire. And those seven heads show what in this Roman Empire? Yes, it shows that there were seven stages, or seven successions of government within the Roman Empire. The beast, you see, pictures the Roman Empire, and these heads, each head shows one particular phase of the Roman Empire, and it went through seven different phases, if you please. All right, and then we learned about this dragon that had a tail that drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and it cast them to the earth. And who did we conclude the third part of the stars of heaven to represent? This is just review. Yes, we understood it to represent the right-hearted bishops and so on in the church. We wanted to take the time. I had some quotations here in the second volume, but I don't know if we better go back into the 12th chapter. We could spend another hour or two on it. But maybe after the meeting or sometime, like if anyone wants these quotations, we can refer you to them. All right, it represents the right-hearted and the spiritual realm that were deposed as events developed in the church, in the ecclesiastical realm. And of course, then we what happened to the dragon after the man-child was born? Remember, the dragon was in heaven. What happened to the dragon when the man-child was caught up to God and to his throne? Yes, the dragon was on the earth where we here see him. And not only was the dragon back on the earth where he belonged, but who else did we find in the earth? Who was with the, who finally was with this dragon, or not related to it, but also who was in the heaven, who later we find in the earth? Well, his angels were cast out with him, but what about the woman? We find her in the wilderness, don't we? Not in the wilderness of heaven so much, but in the wilderness of earth, where Elijah was, and for a similar period of time, for 1260 years. And we finished, we followed this matter through in considerable detail, which we can't go into at this time, but we finished with the dragon in what mood? What was the last thought with regard to this dragon? Yes, he was in a nasty mood. He was angry with the woman, and the account said that he was going to make war with the remnant of this woman's seed. That's where the chapter ends. But that isn't the end of the dragon, and that isn't the end of the woman or her seed. But that's the end of the 12th chapter. We pick up these events later, and they're all related one to the other. You see, this 12th chapter doesn't finish the story. It only takes you, it's like a kind of like a serial, you know. It leaves you in an exciting point where the dragon is angry and he's going to make war with a remnant of her seed, and that's where the 12th chapter ends. It doesn't say any more. And we'll pick up this story later on when we begin to tie the visions together. But now we're interested in another beast, and we'll turn off this beast so we don't get confused. Today, our lesson is along a different line. Another beast. Now, I don't know where I could put this where we could all see it without me having to hold it all the time. Can everyone see this? Well, I'll hold it for the time being until we get familiar with the lesson of the picture of our study. I think, first of all, before we start discussing this matter, we should read a little bit about the description of this beast, and as we read it, keep checking back and see how accurate we have this vision portrayed to us. Who will read the first two verses of Revelation 13? Sister Lillian, do you have it there, please?
And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his head the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his feet and greater authority. Great authority.
Great authority, yes. All right, now here is the description of this beast, and I think the artist did a very good job in giving us a detailed picture of this beast. Notice it says that there was a combination, really, of three beasts. And these three beasts are not unfamiliar beasts in the scriptures. These three beasts, all of them, have a scriptural background. It's just not some beast that the first time we hear them in the Bible. But these three beasts had prominent mention in the book of Daniel. Now, the first of these beasts was like what? I mean that it's likened to. Apparently, it was the most spectacular thing about this beast. In other words, I think John listed this in the way that it impressed him. The first thing he noticed, that there was something about this, and he listed first. Yes, it was like a leopard. The body of the beast was like a leopard. It had spots like a leopard and so on. And perhaps had a shape very much like a leopard. All right? Does anyone remember a leopard in the Old Testament?
Greece was represented by a leopard in Daniel.
That's right. In the 7th chapter of Daniel, you'll find there that Greece was represented by a leopard. So this animal had some similarity to Greece, to the Grecian Empire. All right, then the next element, it had the feet of a bear. Any animal in the Old Testament that was given specific mention?
Medo-Persia.
Yes, Medo-Persia was represented by a bear. And this particular beast had feet like a bear. And that, you know, the feet of a bear are the most unusual thing about the animal. They're almost like human hands, except for the fact that they don't have the human wrist and thumb, but they use their paw, as it were, very much like we use our hand, not only for walking, but they use it to feed themselves and catch things with it. They reach in tree trunks, you know, and get honey, and they catch fish with it. It's very versatile. It's more like a hand than it is a paw, which is unique. You see, this animal is a unique animal. All right, this had a similarity to the Medo-Persian Empire. And also, the last beast that had the mouth of what? A lion. Now we see all these things represented here. The Babylonian Empire was represented by a lion in Daniel. And the whole beast, you know, there was a fourth beast in Daniel that was exceeding dreadful, terrible. And does that remind you of this beast in any way? This is a dreadful beast. In other words, this shows us a government, something that has all the background of the four universal empires within it. All the subtlety, all the craft, all the hiddenness, shown by, for instance, the spots of a leopard, which makes it camouflage, hard to see. It's hard to tell when a leopard is on the scene because of that unique camouflage that they have. They can be standing almost on top of you, and you can't hardly see them until they move. And then the feet of a bear. I remember Medo-Persia, when they marched in under the gates of the city of Babylon, it's almost like a bear reaching under the gates and getting the populace there within the city. Well, this beast had all that subtlety too, graspingness. And then it had the mouth of a lion. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, he was lifted up, he spoke great, swelling things about himself. Well, this lion's mouth was on this beast too. And on top of this, how many crowns did this beast have, and where are they located?
10 crowns were located on
its head. Yes, on the horn. That's right, it has 10 crowns. Now, how many, 7 from 10 makes how many difference? In other words, the beast we saw here, the dragon, had how many crowns? It had 7. This has 10. There's 3 crowns differentiation. And there's a difference in where these crowns are placed. The dragon that we discussed last week had the crowns on its head. This has the crowns on its horn. Now, these are all, the only thing that's similar about this beast and the dragon is what? Yeah, that's about it. The only similarity between them is the 7 heads. They all had 7 heads, which identifies to our minds what? What would we conclude if they all the beasts, there are 3 beasts in Revelation that have 7 heads. And what would we conclude?
Same powers?
Well, yes, they had in a way same powers. That isn't so much the thought, I don't think, but they fit into what? Isn't it the same time element? They each fit into the 7 stages of the Roman Empire. That's a thought I think we can gather from the 7 heads, but that's the only similarity. We see great differences. Now, first of all, there is a discrepancy here. And it's these discrepancies that they're not really discrepancies. They're things that come up in the scriptures that will either prevent us from making a conclusion or show us the conclusion that we have already made is wrong, or else it'll guide us in making a better conclusion, a clearer conclusion, and identifying the things that are to come. Now, for instance, what I'm getting at, this may sound confusing, but in the last chapter that we studied, in Revelation, the 12th chapter, we found that the dragon made war with Michael. And who was Michael in that instance? Well, yes, it represented the man of sin, particularly, and that would include the Pope. That's when it became really the, in the highest sense of the word, although in other stages it could be referred to as a man of sin even before that. But when the church finally accepted an earthly head, that's when Brother Austin said it became the man of sin. Up till then, the picture of a woman is used. But when they accept an earthly headship, then they become the man of sin. Just like we, the church, are pictured by a woman until we are joined with Christ in holy matrimony, and then it is shown as the Christ's body, which is masculine. And we are pictured in that. All right. There was war in heaven, though. The dragon wasn't willing to give the man of sin the complete run of the heavens, was he? According to the Revelation, the 12th chapter. There was a war in heaven about who was to have the control of the heavens. And who lost the war?
The dragon
lost it. The dragon was cast out of heaven. He was cast out of the spiritual realm. In other words, when Constantine entered the church, he entered it as the Pontifex Maximus. And he was the one that called the Council of Nicaea, and it was he that finally decided, or had the bishops decide with him, what was the proper conclusion of the matters, and which way the official position of the church was going to be. But you see, that didn't continue indefinitely. It wasn't for an indefinite period where the emperors lay down the law in the church, in the spiritual realm, as to what was right and what was wrong. That position was soon lost by the civil powers, by the dragon. And the ecclesiastical realm, the Pope, and the ones from within the church gained control of the heavens. And they cast the civil power out of the voice of authority in the heavens. I think that was our conclusion from our last study. But now here, you'll notice a complete reversal. In this picture, we see the dragon, instead of making war with with Michael, which we say was the man of sin, why, he turns around and he says, well, here's the seat, and he gives him his power, and he gives him great authority, and everyone marvels at this. Now, apparently a contradiction. Revelation, the 12th chapter, there was a war in heaven about Michael getting a place there, a throne in heaven. And even the dragon lost it. He didn't give it. He lost it. He lost the war and he landed up on earth. But this account shows that the dragon was willing, he was glad, he turned around and he gave his seat and his great authority unto the beast. Well, we didn't read that part, but we better read it now. Verses 3-7. Will somebody read that, please? Well, we did read that, and it says, and the dragon. Yeah, the second verse, we did read that part. Well, that's all right. We'll read the next three verses, too. Will somebody read that? Volunteer. Not will draft people. All right, thank you.
And I saw on his head, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all all the world wondered after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. The power was given unto him to continue 40 years to one. And he opened his mouth and blasphemed against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints, and to overcome them, and power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations.
Yes. Now, here is the I think the explanation, the secret of this seemingly contradictory proposition. And see, if we were wrong in our conclusions in our last lesson, it would come right up here. We either were dead wrong in concluding that the Michael there represented the man of sin, or else we've got to qualify this chapter in another sense. And we're unwilling to conclude that we were wrong, because we were satisfied with the lessons that we gathered from here that it was right. This man-child that was caught up to God in his throne did represent the man of sin. But this is no contradiction whatever. This shows a different proposition entirely. This is talking, where is this vision? Where is the setting of this vision to start with? Is it in heaven or in earth? The 13th chapter. Where do we get the picture?
Earth.
Yes. It's not talking about heaven. It's not talking about the controversy between the emperors and the bishops as to who is to be the big fish in the pond and who is to decide the issues in the church and create the dogmas in the church. This is on an earthly plane. This shows the Roman Catholic system not so much as a church, but as a government in the civil world. On the earthly plane, it rose up out of the sea, and it came upon the, stood upon the sand of the seashore. It's not a heavenly picture. It's not talking about the ecclesiastical realm at all. You see, this I think is an important part. But once we do see this distinction, why, it helps us to understand in what respect are we to consider this dragon or this leopard-like beast. We're to consider it as a government. While it has spiritual aspects to it, there's no doubt you can't entirely separate the man of sin from it. But we must think of it, this picture, as showing the Roman Catholic system as a government, as a power in the Roman Empire, in the civil part of the Roman Empire. And in that respect, we find that the emperors were glad to give the church seat and great authority. In the second volume, we have, many quotations here, but we'll refer to a few to show that it's the papacy's evolving into the civil powers of the earth that is here referred to. On page 293, the second volume, we quote, it says, Thus under Constantine's reign, all hindrance was finally removed, and as we shall find, the organization of the papacy and the church nominal under the headship of the Bishop of Rome as Pope was speedily effected. And on page 297, Brother Russell quotes from a Catholic writer to show the rise of the papacy in temporal power, that is, in the earthly affair. And here's what we read. I'll read the paragraph that introduces the paragraph so you get the setting. Brother Russell says that a Roman Catholic writer fully corroborates our findings on this subject. And we present his words, regardless of their gloss, as corroborative testimony, giving with glowing enthusiasm a description of the rise of the papacy to temporal power, describing it as a plant of heavenly origin and therefore of rapid growth and high exaltation in the world, he says. We quote. This is a Roman Catholic historian. He says, the rise of the temporal power of the popes. Now, we're not talking about the ecclesiastical power. Remember, this is the temporal power in the civil realm and the earth that our picture is concerned with. The rise of the temporal power of the popes presents to the mind one of the most extraordinary phenomena which the annals of the human race offer to our wonder and admiration. By a single combination of concurring circumstances, a new power and a new dominion grew up silently and steadily on the ruins of that Roman Empire which had extended its sway over or made itself respected by nearly all the nations, peoples, and races that lived in the period of its strength and glory. And that new power of lowly origin struck a deeper root and soon exercised a wider authority than the empire whose gigantic ruins it saw shivered into fragments and moldering in the dust. In Rome itself, the power of the successor of Peter grew side by side with and under the protecting shadow of that of the emperor. Notice, grew side by side and under the protecting shadow of the emperor. There you see is the dragon giving him his seat and great authority. And such was the increasing influence of the popes that the majesty of the supreme pontiff was likely ere long to dim the splendor of the purple, that is, of the emperor. The removal by Constantine of the seat of the empire from the west to the east, from the historic banks of the Tiber to the beautiful shores of the Bosphorus, laid the broad foundation of a sovereignty which in reality commences from that momentous change. Practically almost from that day, Rome, which had witnessed the birth, the youth, the splendor, and the decay of the mighty race by whom her name had been carried with her eagles to the remotest regions of the then known world, was gradually abandoned by the inheritors of her renown, and its people deserted by the emperors, an easy prey to the ravages of the barbarians, whom they had no longer the courage to resist, beheld the Bishop of Rome, their guardian, their protector, their father. Year by year, the temporal authority of the popes grew into shape and hardened into strength without violence, without bloodshed, without fraud, by the force of overwhelming circumstances fashioned as if visibly by the hand of God. There we see, there's no contradiction in the picture. This picture shows the papacy as its rise as a government in the earth. And this account is true. It was, except for the part about being the hand of God, it was the hand of the God of this world. But this quietly, this leopard-like beast gradually gained greater renown than the emperors that wore the purple up to that time. So we see that this is a picture of the beast, as we are shown here, a picture of the Roman Catholic Church rising in temporal power. And it reaches its peak, and then continues how long? What does the account say? How long does this beast have power? 42 months. And how long was the woman in the wilderness? And what's the relationship? The same period of time. One was 1260 days. Now notice, while this beast is in the zenith of its power and glory, where is the woman? Same period of time. She's in the wilderness. Now you notice how accurate these pictures are. We see no contradiction, but we see that one is focusing the first vision started off in heaven. That accounts for the war there and the unwillingness of the emperor to lose control of the spiritual realm, which he ultimately did, and became strictly the realm of the Pope and his cardinals and his bishops and so on. He lost that. And the dragon, however, was willing and glad to give the Pope a seat in the temporal government. And they did. Well, even before Constantine's time, remember in the second volume, Paul speaks of Paul of Samosata, this bishop in the time of Diocletian. He was so influential that he was receiving a fabulous sum, something like $77,000 a year in our money. An influential person in the state. And so, you see, the emperors were glad to, maybe I better just give you a brief snatch of some of this in the second volume, because sometimes it's hard to realize that these things are not in the volumes, but we're not presenting something that's out of the realm of the scripture studies. Here, just this was even before Constantine gave official recognition to the papacy. This was under the terrible persecution of Diocletian. We think of the Christians as all being in such a bad way, but they weren't. Here's the story of Paul of Samosata, who filled the metropolitan see, the bishopric of Antioch, while the east was in the hands of Odenatus and Zenobia, may serve to illustrate the condition and character of the times, about AD 270. Paul considered the service of the church a very lucrative profession. This is Paul of Samosata, not Paul the Apostle. His ecclesiastic jurisdiction was venal and rapacious. He exhorted frequent contributions from the most opulent of the faithful and converted to his own use a considerable part of the public revenues. It is claimed by critics as given that Paul held the office of imperial ducenarius, or procurator, with an annual salary of 200 sesterta, about 77,000. Well, that would be about three times that amount now in our deflated dollar. By his pride and luxury, the Christian religion was rendered odious in the eyes of the Gentiles. His council chamber and his throne, the splendor with which he appeared in the public, the suppliant crowd which solicited his attention, the multitude of letters and petitions to which he dictated his answers, the perpetual hurry of business in which he was involved, were circumstances which much better suited to the state of a civil magistrate than to the humility of a primitive bishop. When he harangued his people from the pulpit, Paul affected the figurative style and the theatrical gestures of an Asiatic sophist, while the cathedral resounded with the most extravagant acclamations in the praise of his divine eloquence. Against those who resisted his power or refused to flatter his vanity, the prelate of Antioch was arrogant, rigid, and inexorable, but he relaxed the discipline and lavished the treasures of the church on his dependent clergy. So you see that even before Constantine, there was a bid by the church for power, but it wasn't until Constantine's time that he finally, you know, when Constantine came to the throne, well, it tells us right in the second volume that there were six aspirants to the emperor's throne. And the Roman Empire was really in a shaky position. And it was Constantine who saw the possibilities of exploiting the church to strengthen his hand in the government. And that was the strategic move to make. As soon as he made his union with the state, then it was that Constantine, by giving a civil authority to the state and recognizing them as a state religion and so on, then it was that Constantine seated himself on the throne and rubbed out his other successors. Why, the year that he entered the church to show his insincerity was the same year that he had his own son, I guess, executed according to the second volume here. He was an unscrupulous politician, and he entered the church to gain its power, and he was willing to give the church power as long as it would uphold the throne, and it did just what he suggested. In the second volume, it shows how that the bishops that met with him later, with the emperor, had those exiled and excommunicated and driven from their bishops, exiled, those that wouldn't go along with this new church-state arrangement. So you see, it was a clever move on his part. He was glad to give this beast seat and power and great authority. And that's what the account shows, that is, in the civil matters. Otherwise, we have a contradiction. In the religious realm, it wasn't just that way. It was just the opposite. Now, are there any questions up to this point? Any comments or anything that you just don't understand?
Brother Gene?
Brother Stewart?
In the second verse, you were talking about the three beasts in Daniel. You got Rome in there too. Just how did that fit? It's easy enough to see this, the three beasts that are named. And how did the fourth beast of Daniel fit in there?
Well, this is only, it doesn't say that, it's only my way of seeing it. You notice the sequence. It starts off with the last empire before, that is, it was the Grecian Empire. And then it goes back to the Medo-Persian Empire, and then it goes back to the Babylonian. And it starts off with the beast itself, which was a terrible-looking beast that Daniel, when he saw it, he didn't describe what it was. He just said it was exceeding dreadful. And so, in that respect, this beast is dreadful like the civil aspects of the Roman Empire itself. Although this is the papal empire in the Roman picture. That is a point that maybe isn't well taken. I don't know. It's just a thought.
Would the ten horns fit them together too?
Well, in the Daniel's account, I don't think there were ten horns. It was. Is there in the seventh chapter?
Yes, and then.
Yes.
A little horn came up later.
I thought it was three great horns that were plucked up, and then the one little horn that emerged.
Verse 7 ends up, it had 10 horns.
Oh yeah, well then there's an identifying feature which would relate it, that's right. But in that picture, of course, in Daniel, you see the papacy, this monstrous thing as shown by that little horn that cropped up, and it spoke great swelling things. But this is a separate picture, and it shows a detail. A picture of this little horn, as it were, as a beast, as a power, as a government in temporal affairs in the Roman Empire. I think that's what the picture conveys. Brother Gene, Brother Charles.
Did you touch on where it speaks of, I saw one of the heads, as it were, wounded to death?
Not yet. So that, I think, we'll mention later. We read that, but we didn't discuss all that we've read so far. Well, maybe we'd better get into that, unless there are some other questions that anyone might have at this time. Well, now, we notice there's a differentiation here in the crown. This picture has 10 crowns, and the crowns are on the horns. What lesson do we think we could gather from this, if any?
That the ten powers given these crowns by the divine might.
Well, yes.
There is no power.
Yes, and these crowns are really the crowns which the papacy would recognize. In other words, see, the papacy always felt this way about it. They didn't really recognize any emperors. Emperors, as far as they personally were concerned, were dust under their feet if they had their way. They couldn't say it just that way because they were usually powerful enough that they had a reckon with them. But the ones whom they claimed had a right to rule were the kings that they blessed, were the kings that they crowned, were the kings that the papacy chose to put into power. In other words, the papacy had a lot to do with these territorial governments within the Roman Empire, these littler kings, not the emperor over the whole empire, but under these territorial divisions. The papacy recognized the territorial division, but they did not recognize the headship of the emperor. I think that seems to be the thought. I don't know if I've made myself clear or not. It's kind of a difficult thing to explain. But we do see that there is a difference here. There were seven crowns in the other picture, and they were upon the head in the rightful place where we would expect them to be, on the governmental powers that were in authority. As each succession of government would come, they would have the right to rule, and from God's standpoint, it was really to be that way, that the powers were to be vested in the heads of these successive governments. Whereas this recognizes the kings that the papacy crowned and uncrowned. Those are the ones whom they claimed had a right to rule. Well, I think in some respects they're different pictures, but the territorial division is the thought of these ten horns. They represent the ten divisions in the Roman Empire, and the ten kings show that there were rulers within those territorial divisions, whereas the ten toes doesn't show you so much the kings involved, but it does show you the territorial divisions of the Roman Empire, which had their separate government. I think there would be a similarity in that respect. And they'd all fit into the same Roman picture. This is, all of these beasts really are concerned with the Roman picture, except maybe the image of the beast. Well, all right, we'll proceed. The account tells us, after he saw this peculiar beast, that it had seven heads, and one of these heads was wounded, and it was almost unto death. I mean, they thought that would be the end of the beast, that one head should be wounded. Now, what wound do we believe was this that was inflicted upon one of the heads? The Reformation, yes. That's the thought that I think has followed the Bible students' world, and I think it's a correct one. Brother Otho, in the second or third volume, I believe it is, he relates this to the Reformation. He actually says in one place that the first 300 years of papacy's experiences shows her rise in power, and the last 300 years shows her decline in power. Starting with the Reformation, we see the wound that was received upon the head, and that wound was a ghastly one, and the wound really didn't really heal until about the time after Napoleon got done with his exploits. He added the, as it were, the, what do they call it, the coup d'etat, or the coup de grace, the final shot in the head to this thing. But nonetheless, the thing, it didn't kill the beast. The thing continued. Continued for how many more heads? Two. There were seven heads. There weren't eight heads, remember. There were just seven. All of these beasts only have seven. Some try to imply there's eight, but the counts all states there are only seven heads. And this head that was wounded and was healed was the wound that was inflicted by the Reformation. Brother Russell starts it really at Wycliffe's time. But that wasn't too much of a wound. It really became a nasty one about the time when Luther started his work, and it was a very ghastly one about that time. And it was thought to, everyone thought that would be the end of religion in general, be the end of the papacy's power and temporal affairs. But it didn't result that way. No, the reason why this beast wasn't finished off, because this beast had power to continue for 42 months. That was predetermined, that this beast should have that. While the woman was in the wilderness, it was predetermined that she should be there, fed for 1260 days or years. This beast was to receive power for 42 months. Now notice too, they ask a question here in the fourth verse. You know, everyone worshiped the dragon, and they also worshiped this beast. And they said something which is rather remarkable. They said, "Who is like unto the beast, and who is able to make war with him?" No one. Power was given this beast to wear out the saints of the Most High God. No one could make war with her. But don't forget this verse, because someone finally does arrive that does make war with this beast, and he conquers it. Now, they ask the question, and the answer is given in the 19th chapter of Revelation. The final answer of who is able to make war with this beast and conquer it. They don't answer it in this part here, but we get the answer later. You see, all these things begin to relate one to the other. The chain, the link of our chain grows longer, and I think it grows stronger as we begin to relate these matters one to the other. Well now, did that mean when the 42 months were ended, that would be the end of the papacy and that would be the end of its power? Is that what the lesson concludes? It says that power was just given to it for 42 months. What would we conclude from that? Would that be the end of her power? I think not. The picture shows very clearly that the papacy continues much beyond that. But that was, as it were, the zenith of her power. That was the heyday, the glory day of this beast in temporal powers. But Brother Russell never taught that that was the end of the papacy after 1260 years, and that from 1799, why, that's the end of the beast, and we won't see any more of it after that. In the same volume, volume 2, Brother Russell says, I'll read the whole paragraph, but ancient pagan Rome and Babylon had only a mere skeleton of sacerdotal power as compared with the complex and elaborate machinery and contrivances of doctrine and practice of papal Rome. The triumphant successor to their scheme, who now, after centuries of cunning and skill, has its power so entrenched that even today, when its power is outwardly broken, outwardly, see, and it's shorn of its civil dominion, it rules the world and controls kingdoms secretly, undercover, more thoroughly than the Roman emperors ever ruled the kingdom, the kings subordinate to them. That's Brother Russell, page 289, first paragraph. That's a good quotation to remember, because sometimes we hear quotations from Brother Russell's writings that are really taken out of context to show that that's the end of all temporal power, and from that point on, why, that's the last we expect to see of any influence and authority from this church, but from this beast in civil power. But Brother Russell says that it has, even though it's shorn of its dominion, it has more power in the temple affairs than some of the greatest emperors that ruled the world in hitherto days. Well, going on. In the seventh verse, we read more about this war. Will somebody read, starting with the seventh verse through the seven and including ten.
And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints.
Yes. Now notice, this beast, it was given unto him to make war with the saints. And how do we understand that giving? Do you think the Lord blessed him and said, well, go ahead and make war on the saints? Is that the, how the gift was given? Or just what do we understand by it being given unto him to make war with the saints?
He was allowed.
He was allowed. He was permitted. That's the thought we understand from this word given. Not that he had, this beast had the Lord's blessing in this by any means, but rather the Lord allowed this beast to make war with the saints. And Daniel corroborates a similar picture to this when he describes that dreadful beast in Revelation. And Daniel, what does he say? Power was given unto this beast to do what? To wear out the saints of the Most High God. That, it was granted to them to wear out the saints through the centuries. They've been wearing out the saints. You know, they said, who could make war with this beast? Well, some saints did. But they were, see there, the saints were really at war with the thing. Not in a literal war, but in spirit. They were antagonistic to this idea of the papacy being in the civil powers of earth. And they made war with it, but they were worn out. They were overcome by this beast. They weren't in harmony with it. There was a fight on. They get the conflict between the Christ here and the Antichrist, between the papacy and the true Christ. The saints were under fire. They were in a position where they were on the losing side, as it were. Not actually. We know they were victorious in death. But nonetheless, from all physical circumstances, from all outward appearances, the saints were the ones that were losing the battle down through the age. They were being worn out by this beast that had power to overcome them. Oh, is it that long already? Nice. Well, we better stop here then. We'll have a little recess and then we'll start our second portion. A little recess.